You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.
Welcome to the Daily Nationalist. Today's date is Thursday the 26th of August 2021, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at radioalbion.com. We are live today because we have with us geopolitical analyst Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson from russjournal.org. Matt, good day, sir. How are you doing?
It is so humid out here, you could actually see the air. I don't know if I've ever been able to see the air before. But it's so bad out here. My glasses fog up. It is insane. It is incredible. I'm dying here.
Well, I thank you for turning the air conditioner off. And it's cooling down a little bit over here in Britain. We're just starting to see the leaves are starting to go a little bit golden brown. It's autumn is here and everybody's out and about. And the COVID restrictions have finally lifted. And of course, COVID restrictions have been lifted for a very long time over in China. And they have dealt with the COVID scare in a completely different way to the West. And they appear to be having a big uplift with their economy. And they have a completely different way of how they think we should be seeing the world after COVID. And we're going to be talking about that today. We have an article here by Peter Koenig for Global Research, which we're going to be discussing, which talks about China's vision for a multipolar world. Post-pandemic for many countries, especially Western countries, is a dream. The West will have to wake up fast if it doesn't want to fall prey to a destructive plan of chaos, unemployment, bankruptcies, and yes, famine, the shifting of capital from the bottom and the middle to the top, and leaving misery at the bottom. Not so for China. For China, the post-pandemic era is well underway. When COVID hit Wuhan in January 2020, Chinese authorities proceeded rapidly to prevent the spread of this new disease by a radical lockdown of Wuhan and extending it to Hubei province. Later, other areas of risk were locked down, including about 80% of China's production and manufacturing apparatus. The result was astounding. Within a few months, by about mid-2020, China was in control of COVID and gradually started opening up crucial areas, including the production process, all the while maintaining strict protection measures. Now, what he isn't saying here is about the cycles in their PCR testing. And China has actually been doing the correct number of cycles in the PCR testing, which shows that only says that people actually have COVID when they really do have COVID. They don't actually get any false positives. So they have had far less numbers of people with COVID than we have. And I think they've only had actually one scare since they opened up again. What do you make of what they have to say here about the way that China dealt with COVID, Matt?
Well, you know, we were some of the first, actually the first, to talk about this systematically on this show, that they took action immediately. Remember, the Wuhan lab is owned by the Americans. I mean, it's a multinational place, but Big Pharma owns that lab. The Republicans talking about this being a Chinese institution, or they're deliberately being dishonest. But they took action immediately. They ended up arresting, I think, 150 bureaucrats for the mishandling of this case. I don't think anyone in America has been arrested. So they took this very seriously. They cut the place off. Their economy took a huge – how can they have deliberately created this when their economy took a huge hit in an area that's doing very well? And because they do not just the better PCR test, but the blood tests, which is becoming more and more common there, they have a much better – set of numbers. So the Americans immediately say that they must be fudging the numbers and everything else. And by the way, this Peter Koenig works for the World Bank. He is a geopolitical analyst there. So you at least have somebody working for the regime that says this is nonsense, and that the Chinese economic model is better.
According to China's PCR testing, America has something like 400,000 times as many cases as China does. I mean, China is looking as if they really have got a hold of this in a much better way than the rest of the world. But by the end of 2020, China's economy was practically working at full speed and achieving, according to the IMF's very conservative account, a 2.6% growth for the year. China's own and perhaps more realistic projections were closer to 3.5%. IMF growth projections for China in 2021 stand at 8.4%. China's economic expansion in 2022 is projected at 5.6%. This is way above any other country in the world. Compare this with 2020 economic declines, way into the red, for the US and Europe of 25% to 35% and 10% to 15%, respectively. These are real figures, not necessarily the published ones. Future expansion in China takes into account that much of the projected growth over the coming years will be internal, horizontal growth, helping China's interior and western provinces catch up with infrastructure, research and development, as well as education facilities, increasing the overall level of well-being to reduce the gap with the highly developed eastern areas. China's economic recovery and her industrial apparatus working at full speed is good for China and good for the world, because China had become, in the past four decades or so, the Western principal supply chain, mainly for the US and Europe. We are talking crucial supplies, such as medical equipment, medication, and ingredients for medication. About 80%, 90% of those used in the West come from China. I'm amazed at that. 80 to 90% of the ingredients for medication are now coming from China. Doesn't this really sort of put us at risk of them suddenly cutting the supply chain, Matt?
They have every variable on their side. They hold every weapon. Not just this kind of thing. They're making components for Boeing, you know, military equipment being made over there. The medicine. I mean, I've come across these figures before. Their recovery has been self-financed. They're not going to the banks. This has been actually happening for some time. Once the old Maoist guard were rounded up and imprisoned, the IMF came in, offered them their assistance, and they were sent packing. And it's one of the reasons that they're doing so well. And it's not just high economic growth, but the fact that they're now dedicated to an even growth that's both geographically even and that you don't develop an oligarchy. So they're worried about a basic kind of equality here and making sure that this it would be a liberal oligarchy, doesn't take over, partially because it would challenge them and partly because it would completely destroy this whole nationalist ideology that China's developed. And then besides that, they own so many dollars, although they're selling American equity now. Which is the Americans' fault. They have a massive amount of gold. The U.S. has zero. They have pieces of paper. The U.S. is in no position to start a war over Taiwan or anything else. This is just bluster to create some kind of a unity in a political system that today no one trusts in the U.S. That is not the case in China, by the way.
It's interesting you bring up Taiwan. Grandpa Dan was pointing out this week that now would probably be a very good time for China to move and maybe try to take Taiwan back. We'll have to see whether they take any advantage of Dan's advice there. Well, China's rapid economic growth may be mostly attributed to two main factors: large-scale investments, financed by predominantly domestic savings and foreign capital, and rapid productivity growth. These two features appear to have gone hand in hand. China remains attractive for investors. In addition to medical equipment, China supplies the West and the world with electronic equipment and is meant to become one of the key developers and exporters of artificial intelligence to accelerate and facilitate research and manufacturing processes, whilst minimizing negative environmental impacts. And I notice they're getting very close to Afghanistan and the Taliban, and in Afghanistan they have all these lithium reserves, which are, of course are needed for all these electronics. So while America has been fighting a losing war there and burning all their bridges, China has just sat back until all of that happened and is now moving in there to take advantage of these lithium supplies. What do you make of all the technology that they're producing over there now, Matt?
Well, the U.S. claims that all of this is stolen technology, which is nonsensical because they still think that China is this third world place. But they don't realize is that Chinese university system is tremendous, has far higher standards to get a degree there than in the U.S. They're churning out a huge number. The fact that the Western capital has been taking advantage of cheap labor there for a long time and attempting to manipulate the system gives China a certain right to take what it can. Because certainly Western corporations do that to each other and the third world all the time. Now with the defeat in Afghanistan, the Chinese have come in and promised to integrate them into the Belt and Road system. And the Taliban have already promised they're not going to have anything. They have no extraterritorial desires. Anyway, they need to consolidate the country first. But they will have nothing to do with the Islamic movement in the west of China. They condemn American attempts to start a war there. And they realize that the Muslims in Western China are doing incredibly well by comparison to, you know, parts of the third world. And their education and their medical establishments there have gone through the roof. And because it's in their interest to develop these almost empty Western regions. So they've already come to these agreements, and Chinese capital is going to be partially reconstructing the country, Afghanistan, integrating them to the Belt and Road, engaging in natural gas investment, not to mention the minerals, as you mentioned, which is extremely important. Afghanistan is sitting on a lot of trillions of dollars worth of all kinds of rare earth metals and the rest, which is part of why the war started there in the first place. And there's a certain respect that the Chinese have given to the Taliban because they are a disciplined military force. And they've come together in anti-liberal, anti-American movement. So they may have been opponents, I don't know, 20 years ago. They're not opponents now. And Western arrogance is one of the reasons that that's the case.
Well, China's outlook for the future is bright. However, a number of abnormal factors have to be considered in, like number one, the unresolved COVID issues in the West, which may be reducing demand naturally or by force, possibly import restrictions for goods from China as a way of constant pressure on China. Number two, continuation of a direct and indirect trade and currency war on China. To the detriment of the US dollar, China's currency, the yuan, and soon the digital yuan as an international payment currency, independent from Western-controlled monetary transfer modes, is gaining rapidly in status as an international reserve money. According to some estimates, in 5 years, the yuan may account for up to 30% of all world reserves. As a parenthesis, the US dollar in the early 1990s amounted to more than 90% of worldwide reserve denominations. Today, that proportion has shrunk to less than 60%. And number three, the West, led by Washington, is intent on harming China in whatever way that they can. It will not succeed, and Washington knows it. But it is a typical characteristic of a dying beast to lash around, trying to destroy as much as possible of its surroundings before it collapses. So to me, this is what it looks like it's doing. It looks like China is just waiting for America to collapse. And what Grandpa was pointing out the other day is it's almost on its last legs, the American empire is. And if China wanted to go in and take Taiwan, now would be the good time to do it. But do you think they're just going to wait back, Matt? Or do you think they're going to make any aggressive moves? Or do you think it's best for them just to wait and wait for America to destroy itself?
Well, I think the latter is the strategy. It's like after the American loss in Vietnam, there was discussions as to whether North Korea was going to invade the South, knowing that the U.S. is not going to get involved in yet another East Asian war. However, Taiwan, although small, is far from defenseless. They have military drills, or they used to have military drills or citizen drills in the event of an invasion at least once a month. Every citizen knows just what to do if there's ever an attack. They have an army, highly disciplined, and a militia. They're ready for any attack. It would be extremely bloody for the Chinese to mount any kind of military invasion. I think what might happen is as the U.S. gets worse and worse, the dollar gets less and less valuable. No one trusts American treasuries anymore. The Taiwanese are going to have no choice but to continue to build trading relationships with the mainland. Their so-called illegal trade, as of a few years ago, between China and Taiwan is something like $100 billion a year. It's technically not legal, but no one's standing in the way. I think that has more to do with what their strategy is going to be than actual military force. Yeah, China could take the island, but my God, it would be incredibly bloody. There are depots, arms depots, and military in every square foot of that place. It's like Iwo Jima. It would be one hell of a bloody war if China were to ever do anything. They're ready for any kind of invasion. Every square inch of that place is going to be defended. So I don't think they're going to do that. But the U.S. being a sponsor of Taiwan, despite the U.S. being the one that kicked Taiwan out of the U.N. under Jimmy Carter, just after Mao died, and so now all of a sudden they're back to being a defender of Taiwan again. So when Mao was running China, all of a sudden they're the good guys. Now it's a nationalist China or national socialist China. Suddenly they're the bad guys again. There's only one constant idea there. So I think waiting for the U.S. to finally just, you know, go beyond bankruptcy and having Taiwan have no choice but to continue to build legal relationships with the mainland, I think that's going to be their strategy right now.
So they'll end up economically aligned by default anyway. Well, just as an example, which the world at large is probably unaware of, China is presently surrounded by around 1,400 US military bases or bases of other countries which host US military equipment and personnel. About 60% of the US naval fleet is currently stationed in the South China Sea. China is constantly harassed, sanctioned, and slandered with outright lies. One of the prevalent examples of defamation is her alleged inhuman treatment of the Uyghurs in Xinjiang province. Total population of the Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region in northwestern China is about 26 million, of which some 12 million are Uyghurs, mostly of Muslim belief. Uyghur Muslims are regularly recruited by US secret services from across the border with Afghanistan, being sent in to fight jihad in the Middle East. And when some of them return, China makes an effort to reschool and reintegrate them into society. And this brings up another instance that's happened today. Surprise, surprise, ISIS have just attacked the Kabul airport. So the American army officially move out, and then the unofficial CIA-sponsored jihadi army moves in and attacks them. And it seems that there's a similar thing going on here with the Uyghurs being sent in to attack other places. Are they sent in to attack Afghanistan, or is it other places that they're waging jihad against, Matt?
Are you talking about ISIS or the Taliban?
The Uyghur Muslims. Where are they being sent in?
Well, they're the reason the CIA is so active there. It's what the Chinese are doing ultimately is rebuilding the far west of the country. I did an entire show, I guess it was the Orthodox Nationalist, a few months ago on this Uyghur Xinjiang area. The U.S. has been trying to mobilize these people for a long time. Every one of them, they're legitimate terrorists. They attack civilian centers all the time. They were supposed to be, as I mentioned, allied with the Taliban, but they've already made an agreement. The Taliban wants nothing to do with them because that relationship with China is extremely, there's a tremendous amount of money there. And it's very profitable. And the Taliban are also aware that this Uyghur movement is created by the CIA, as is the Tibetan movement. Again, I've talked about that at great length. China has absolutely no reason to want to harm anyone in Western China. The Uyghur life expectancy have gone to high 40s now to 75, like the rest of the country. There's a massive. I mean, the whole point of taking these terrorists and giving them vocational training, which the West calls concentration camps, that's the strategy here. There's a lot of drugs over there, and building these rehabilitation centers. This has been Chinese strategy here. They need to repopulate that area. The Uyghur population, I think, has doubled over the last few decades, which is a deliberate policy. Obviously, no one's being harmed over there. A massive blitz to build a medical and economic infrastructure. This is obviously in the interest of China. So they're crushing the terrorist movement there, not merely by military force, but by taking these guys and giving them a whole new lease on life. What are they going to do if they won? They took over tomorrow. They're just going to give the country over to Western capital. No one can do a better job. I mean, China has destroyed poverty in that country. Anyone who knows anything realizes this is the greatest anti-poverty movement in world history. The literacy, the poverty, the medical care. what are these guys going to do better? It's ridiculous. You know, they can't have a lot of public support because everyone has been lifted from that part of the world. And they have no allies anywhere except the U.S. because no one really trusts them. The Russians don't trust them. Taliban don't trust them. And no one in China does because everyone knows that this is a Western movement.
So they're basically just trying to integrate them into Chinese society. Or could the real reason for this Western aggression be that Xinjiang province, the largest and westernmost province of China, is also a principal hub for the two or more main routes of the Chinese Belt and Road Initiative, the Trans-Asia routes by rail through Pakistan to the Gwadar port in the Persian Gulf, and possibly by road through the newly to become autonomous Afghanistan, connecting China with Iran. China is perceived as a threat to Western hegemonic thinking, to Western-style globalization, which is the concept of a one-world order over a borderless Western corporate and banking-controlled world. And because China is well-positioned to become the world's number one economy in absolute terms within a few years. In fact, already today, China is number one in purchasing power parity, which is the only indicator that counts, namely how much of goods and services may be acquired with a unit of currency. Can you break that down so it's a little bit easier to understand, Matt?
Well, it's a different way of, you know, GDP is just the number, the amount of economic, the capital, commerce, everything that exists domestically. Purchasing power parity is you take a unit of currency and you connect it with a basket of goods, basically almost like how inflation is figured. So someone says that, oh, the people live on $4 a month, let's say. You hear that phrase all the time. Well, it doesn't mean anything. Well, $4 a month may be something over there. It's not nothing here. And people are talking about how poor they are. They live on, you know, $4 a week or something. But cost of living there is extremely low. I mean, I don't know what the actual number is, but the cost of living is very low. That's how you figure the prosperity of an area, not just some abstract number. You could have two people controlling the economy in an area. That's not reflected in regular GDP or GNP figure. So that he's right. It is the only indicator that counts. China has been, even in absolute terms, the number one economy in the world for a very long time. Because in the U.S., all of the usury, this non-productive banking and financial instruments are included in the GDP number. China is actually producing things, which is why they're going to win this. And the U.S., because it's purely a financial oligarchy, now a monopoly, and the Chinese are producing things. There's no question China has been and that financial oligarchy is dependent on China. Oh, and by the way, I should mention that since over the last few years and Trump's trade war on the Chinese are extracting more and more from American firms that are invested over there. They've always done this. But if you're going to profit, given everything that's going on, you're going to profit here. You're going to profit the local population. There is an interest in foreign capital going into Western China because of these new reforms. But they're not going to go in there by themselves. They're going to be closely watched. CIA is always involved in this kind of thing. And if you're going to profit, that's okay. But China's going to profit too. So the purchasing power parity is a great way to go about this. And you realize with American inflation now going through the roof, the U.S. is plummeting in that department, which is why you don't hear about it very much. You certainly don't hear about it in the major media.
Well, taking these challenges into account and following her non-aggressive and non-expansive moving forward style, China may be embarking on a three-pronged development approach. Overarching this tactic may include China's 2025 plan and 2035-2050 vision, a strong emphasis on economic and defense autonomy. Number one, outreach and connect with the rest of the world through President Xi Jinping's Belt and Road Initiative, also called the One Belt, One Road, OBOR, which is patterned according to the ancient Silk Road more than 2,100 years ago, a peaceful trade route connecting eastern China through Asia, Europe, and the Middle East. On a global scale, this embraces currently more than 130 countries and over 30 international organizations, including 18 countries of the European Union. OBOR offers their partners participation with no coercion. The attraction and philosophy behind OBOR is shared benefits, the concept of win-win. Obor may be the road to socio-economic recovery from COVID consequences and cross-border cooperation for participating countries. Obor is also aiming at a multipolar world where partner countries would equally benefit through infrastructure, industrial joint ventures, cultural exchange, exploration of new renewable sources of energy, research and education projects, working towards a joint future with prosperity for all. Here is the distinction between the Western and the Chinese meaning of globalization. In the West, it means a unipolar world controlled by one hegemon, the US of A, with one army called NATO, which forcibly holds the West, mainly Europe, together. NATO, with its $2.5 billion official budget, unofficially a multiple of this amount, reaching into the trillions, spreads already with its tentacles into South America and Colombia. Together, the West, or the Global North, is a conglomerate of NATO vassal countries with little autonomy, as compared to Chinese globalization, meaning a multipolar connection of countries, all the while Obor-linked countries maintain their sovereignty. This is globalization with Chinese characteristics. Like their communism is socialism with Chinese characteristics. I like the way they talk here about cultural exchange. Of course, you can't have cultural exchange with multiculturalism. Multiculturalism just means you have one mass consumerist culture for all. Whereas what they're talking about here is having unique sovereignty, each country having its own sovereignty, its own way of doing things, and appreciating the different cultures of these different countries. Do you think they're being honest in this, Matt, or do you think they have devious designs on taking over the world?
Yeah, well, as you know, that's the kind of the Republican elite point of view on what's going on here. But this is in China's interest to develop this way. The American system is to use an oligarch, the banks, or BlackRock now, to go in there and make not just economic demands, but political demands. They have to have legal abortion. They have to have, you know, feminism. They have to have some form of affirmative action. They have to have, you know, the state has to go away and the U.S. takes over. Oil companies have police powers over, like they had in Ukraine for a while. In the Chinese case, you don't have the state is involved not so much in ownership, but in directing investment, which is a very different concept of planning. The financing is internal and comes from state institutions. So you don't have the interest built in. Right now, most of the members of the Belt and Road have their payments suspended. Anything they owe to Chinese banks or the Asian bank that they founded to support all this, they don't have to pay for a while, and interest is not being charged. The state can do this, but a private entity can't. There's no one to bail out, in other words. And this is why China was able to survive the 1997 George Soros currency meltdown, because they have state control over the currency. And because they're producing so much, actual real inflation is going to be fairly low. And the way the Americans figure it is a different story. And they're simply lying about this. You have we said before, this is why they're able to come back from COVID so quickly. There's no for-profit here. There's no oligarch media there. And you have a certain level of honesty because you have private media competing with state media, which is the way it probably should be. Everything here is based on national. It's internationalism rather than globalization. Internationalism has actually the word nation in it. It's nations in their particularity coming together and an economic system that will not make these ideological demands. You're right. We're talking about globalization as simple capitalist liberalism, that there are no more cultures. Private companies and advertising agencies and entertainment decide what's cool and what isn't, and they aim at the young people. And Coca-Cola did this all over, destroying the local beverage, traditionally certain kinds of teas and all that, putting them out of business and instituting their own. That's just one example where they're changing the culture here into one mass of consumers, as you say. That's what's happening. And Chinese aren't doing that. They're offering financing at much lower rates with, you know, very, very flexible repayment plans. And they're canceling debts in certain places. No one's going to go to the U.S. and Japanese inspired version of this. I forget the name of it, Prosperity and Freedom, something like that, trying to challenge the Chinese. You have half of Europe supporting China in this. There's no way the Americans are going to win.
And of course, Coca-Cola are now trying to erase whiteness. And number two, in a precautionary detachment from Western dependence, China is focusing trade development and cooperation with her ASEAN partners. In November 2020, after 8 years of negotiations, China signed a free trade agreement with the 10 ASEAN nations, plus Japan, South Korea, Australia and New Zealand, altogether 15 countries, including China. The so-called Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, or RCEP, covers some 2.2 billion people, commanding about 30% of the world's GDP. This is a never-before-reached agreement in size, value and tenor. China and Russia have a long-standing strategic partnership containing bilateral agreements that also enter into this new trade fold. The countries of the Central Asian Economic Union, consisting mostly of former Soviet republics, as well as members of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, are likewise integrated into the Eastern Trade Bloc. The RCEP's trade deals will be carried out in local currencies and in yuan, no US dollars. The RCEP is therefore also an instrument for de-dollarizing, primarily in the Asia-Pacific region and gradually moving across the globe. Well, I can see America is going to be pretty concerned about that if all the deals are being done in yuan instead of in the dollar, Matt.
Yeah, and the ruble is a part of this too. ASEAN, well, it was in the 1960s. Actually, it was an American movement. Indonesia, Malaysia, the Philippines, Singapore, Thailand. Now, given the Chinese strategy here, they have a completely different idea. Burma is a part of it. Cambodia, a few other places have become members. This is a way that the Chinese can integrate this part of the world economically without forcing this ideological usury regime here. So they've taken an American organization and have taken it over. This is what happens when you have a far superior system, the Central Asia Economic Union. I've talked about the SCO, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, for a very long time. These are the anti-liberal movements the world over, and they're successfully challenging American liberalism, and this is why no one in the U.S. is talking about it, despite these countries being these institutions being extremely significant. And now India and Pakistan are involved. And that means that's where Afghanistan gets integrated into all this. And with the Americans driven out, having lost here, the American economic problems, the division in American politics, no one takes the U.S. seriously. No one thinks that they're a big threat. We've been talking about this for a very long time. Now it's been made very graphic.
Number three, China will focus much of her future development on her internal and Western regions, increase the standard of well-being of populations, infrastructure, research and development, industrial development, joint ventures, including with foreign capital. To achieve a better equilibrium between Eastern and Western, China is crucial for socio-economic sustainability. This dual development approach, on the one hand, external trade with close ASEAN associates, as well as with OBOR partners, and on the other, achieving internal equilibrium and well-being, is a circular development, feeding one on the other, minimizing risks and impacts of Western adversarial aggression. China's achievements in her 71 years of revolution speak for themselves. They are unmatched by any nation in recent history. From a country largely ruined by Western-influenced colonization and conflicts, China arose from the ashes by not only lifting 800 million people out of poverty, but also by becoming food, health, and education self-sufficient. Coinciding with the 4th of March 2021 opening of the Chinese People's Political Consultative Conference, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., the late President John F. Kennedy's nephew, said, "Unless we move from a civilization based on wealth accumulation to a life-affirming ecological civilization, we will continue accelerating towards global catastrophe." This understanding is also at the forefront of China's vision for the next 15 to 20 years and beyond. A China internal objective is an equitable development to well-being for all, and on a world scale, a community with shared benefits for all. Matt, what are your final thoughts on this today?
Just a year or so ago, the Ash Center for Democratic Governance and Innovation, which is at Harvard University, did a poll of thousands of Chinese citizens. 90% of the Chinese support their state. 73% of the Chinese think their country has a representative government, which is far higher than the U.S. and places, the more so-called marginalized groups, the Tibetans, the Uyghurs, all of them have very, not as high, that high, but increasing support for the Chinese government. They said at bringing 800 million people out of extreme poverty and building hospitals, this may have something to do with why the Chinese are so popular. It's a legitimate popularity, and it's just going to get better.
Well, thank you very much for coming on today. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. I will be back tomorrow with Grandpa Dan. God bless and hail victory.
You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.